Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings Magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now, here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We're now certainly midway in our third season, and we're just as excited as ever to continue to help you explore and understand the unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of our planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here are issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, digestive issues, gut health issues, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen in today as we interview an expert for today's show on cities, built environment, and infrastructure. And today we're going to talk about healthy cities and healthy people and that intersection with our built environment. Now, our built environment basically includes all human-made physical spaces around us. The built environment basically defines the spaces in which we live, where we work, where we play. It affects our land uses, whether it's commercial or housing or industrial or what have you. The built environment affects and dictates our natural resource consumption, as well as the patterns or the ways and places where we dispose of our waste. And of course, these include our buildings, our furnishings, public spaces that we build, roads, utilities, bridges, airports, other types of built or infrastructure. And these structures and spaces affect our health very directly and indirectly by bringing pollutants into our environment and by allowing or perhaps restricting access to our physical activity. They affect our transportation modes and patterns, and they also affect our social interaction. Overall, it's estimated that in the United States, the built environment accounts for 68% of the electricity that's consumed here, and it uses more than a third of all of our primary energy. The built environment is responsible for about 35% of our country's greenhouse emissions, and it consumes about 12% of the potable or usable water. And in construction activities and demolition waste alone, our built environment produces in excess of 136 million tons annually. Our built environment influences a person's life and probably all of our activities. It can lead to poor health outcomes, including chronic diseases and cancers. Now, how our communities, though, are planned, designed, and built can have a major influence then on our health, as you can see. It determines really how long and how healthy each of us lives. Now, the environment also plays certainly an important role in the dynamic of diseases and in determining the health of individuals as well as society as a whole. Specifically, though, the built environment has a large impact on the prevention and the containment of both chronic and infectious diseases in humans and in animals. The effects of the built environment on health can be direct, for example, by influencing the environmental quality, or they can be indirect by influencing people's behaviors. That can then, of course, lead to or impact the transmission of disease and other health issues. And furthermore, these types of impacts can happen at many scales, all the way down from the one-on-one individual level to a societal level, all the way from the design of the plates that we eat on to the design of the cities that we live in. So there's no escaping it for all of us. Again, our individual and our population is affected by the environment in which we all live. And some environments perhaps have more pathogens or disease-causing agents than others. And things such as population densities can vary access to the environmental benefits that we all need. And again, it can also just really have a big influence on how diseases and other health issues are transmitted. However, we do know that the built environment can be modified to promote healthy behaviors and therefore reduce the risk of contracting and spreading diseases. In fact, the degree to which that built environment significantly affects the public's health was perhaps most obvious when, at that time in our past, when infectious disease was the primary public health threat. And that was during times of the Industrial Revolution, when there were unsanitary conditions, there was overcrowding in the big urban tenements, and things of that nature. However, though, even today, the age of chronic disease, there still remains an important connection between the overall population health and this built environment. Physical spaces can expose people to toxins or pollutants, as well as influence our lifestyles and contribute to things such as diabetes, coronary vascular disease, and asthma. And we recently saw a little of this connection between space, people, behavior, and diseases during the quick and wild onspread of COVID. But this is a lot. And so we want to begin to try to unpack it and understand that it all some more. And here today to help us with this is Dr. Jacoby Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a researcher in community engagement and environmental justice and a professor at the University of Maryland in their School of Public Health. He is with their Institute for Applied Environmental Health and the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, and he is at the College Park campus. Dr. Wilson has over 20 years of experience and work as an environmental health scientist in the areas of exposure science, environmental justice, environmental health, and much more. Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today, Shaq. He said I could call him Shaq.
I haven't actually heard anybody call me with Dr. Shaq. Well, no, maybe they have. Very few people, but yes, thank you. That's one of my college nicknames. Happy to be here. Kobe Wilson, thanks for having me here.
Thank you. And did I get all of that right about what you do and where you are there?
Yes, thank you for that. I direct the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice and Health, so I'm really excited to talk about the built environment and environmental justice today.
Thank you. And we just feel so lucky to get you because I know your schedule is booked up for the next few weeks. So again, thank you and welcome. So I want to start out, though, by talking about what makes a healthy city or how you would describe a healthy city and then move on into the built environment factors having to do with that healthy city.
Yeah, to me, a healthy city is a city that has, you know, systems that work together that produce healthful conditions, right? So you can have your built systems, you can have your natural systems, you have your social systems, you have your economic systems, you know, all these systems, political systems too. All these systems work together to create healthful conditions that then the people who live in those cities can benefit from those healthful conditions.
An example of just some of those so that our listening audience can understand what are the built environment factors and what makes for the built environment. Then I want to bring it together with healthy city.
So you think about the built environment. I mean, the built environment is basically any man-made structure, any man-made environment. So it's really about what we live, what we work, what we play, what we pray, what we learn. All those are built environments, right? Except for the outdoor environment, right? It could be ambient. So you have housing as part of the built environment. Transportation is part of the built environment. You know, our schools are part of the built environment. Where we our occupational spaces are part of the built environment. You know, our healthcare infrastructure, that's part of the built environment. So all those things make up the built environment. And so again, it's about where we live, where we work, where we play, where we pray. Our churches, our mosques, other places of worship. You know, what we learn. All those things are part of our built environment, and these parts of the built environment work together. So if you have parts of your built environment that themselves are unhealthy, right, then the people who live in those built environment spaces, who go to school in those built environment spaces, who work in those built environment spaces, right, who play in those built environment spaces, who learn in those built environment spaces, who pray in those built environment spaces, they're also going to be unhealthy.
Indeed. And that's why I wanted to kind of just flesh that out first. What's a healthy city? How do we describe that? What are we talking about? What do we mean? What are we envisioning when we say built environment? And as you just finished, the big statement and the thing that we really want to dissect is that intersection of how people are affected, healthy people, healthy cities are affected by the built environment. In other words, how do healthy cities affect or interact with the people. I want to give some examples, and usually the examples, unfortunately, are the bad things that happen, but that's when it kind of comes to our radar for people to really get an example of how that built environment, how the environment around them can affect their health.
Yeah, if you think about, you know, one framework I like to use when we talk about the you know, healthy cities and, you know, how you build healthy community ecosystems, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this guy named Antonovsky. He talked about this term, pseudogenesis, which I would define. It's about how you promote health, well-being, wellness, quality of life across all dimensions of the environment. So you have the built environment. You have the natural environment. You have the social environment. You have the economic environment. You also have the political environment. And you have the spiritual environment. So all those things are important components or features of a city, right? As I said before, when you think about the built environment, let's talk about food, for example. So some of you may live in communities where you don't have a grocery store nearby in walking distance or in biking distance or really in driving distance. So that term we used to call a food desert. Some of you may say, well, I have food access. I got a fast food restaurant down the street. But that's not a food desert. That's a food swamp. A food swamp is an area that has bad food, or my scientific term is crappy food, right? But the system that leads to food deserts and food swamps, those are the symptoms. The system is food apartheid. That's a term coined by a food activist in Chicago, LaDonna Redmond, about how Black communities and brown communities didn't have access to food infrastructure. And you had mass transit take you 3 buses to get back.
I'm going to need to interrupt you, unfortunately, because we've got to go to a break. And we'll be right back on the other side of that with Dr. Shacobi Wilson, who's talking to us about built infrastructure and all the ins and outs of it. And he's on food. And we're going to continue that on the other side. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all Whole Foods markets, natural grocers, central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Check them out at nhg.com. And our other sponsors, Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today, to our show today on cities, built environment, and infrastructure. And today we're looking at healthy cities, healthy people, and that intersection with the built environment. And today we have with us Dr. Shacobi Wilson from the University of Maryland. He's there at College Park outside of D.C. Again, thank you for being with us. Before the break, Shacobi was telling us, you know, about various intersections of the built environment and healthy cities and our health. And it was really interesting, and I got all wound up in it because we're looking at things that are just in front of our faces that people are probably don't realize as part of our built environment and how it affects us. And only when those two things are done can we begin to drive that train and direct its impact. So you were talking about how we do have the food deserts and food apartheid. Some areas have food, others don't. And so the big thing I really like to always get at in this show is, why must the rest of us who are not in food deserts, who are not affected by, like, the food apartheid, why must we care?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about areas that don't have access to good food infrastructure, right? So whether it be food deserts or food swamps, that means if you look at the other parts of the built environment, so think about walkable, livable communities, they don't have biking trails, they don't have walking trails, pedestrian family trails. They may live in areas where, you know, parks are green space, right? But we build parks, right? We modify the land to create parks. So think about the combination of not having access to food, not having the ability to exercise, not having access to parks. You know, context matters, place matters. So what that leads to in many ways is adverse health outcomes. For some populations who may be living in food deserts and food swamps, they may eat foods that are not healthy. So maybe a lot of calories, which contribute to metabolic syndrome, which means they can then be what we call obesogenic environments, which is these are environments that basically are unhealthy and maybe you may have an unhealthy weight, and have an unhealthy weight may lead to, again, these adverse health outcomes, like diabetes, right, like heart disease. So for the folks who don't live in a food desert and food swamp, when we have a large swath of our population who do, and they have to rely on social safety nets or health safety nets, who pays for that? We all pay for that, right? So healthcare costs go up, premiums go up, right? Insurance costs goes up. So we all pay for that. So we want to make sure that we support evidence-based policies that say that in communities that don't have access to good food infrastructure, we need to make sure they have access to farmers markets, they have access to grocery stores, they have access to supermarkets, that they have access to urban agriculture. I mean, one great way to provide access to food, if the farmer's not right down the road, is to bring the farm to you. I mean, I love the idea of food cities. I mean, one of the solutions actually is to make sure we're growing food in our cities. I think, you know, food is health, food is wealth, food is power, right?
And indeed, so, but I just want to go back to something you said when we were talking about the cost of it. Yep. As to why those of us who don't live in food deserts or who don't experience that food apartheid, why it's not an option that we care about those who do. And you mentioned the healthcare cost. And I really like to be able to bring this up, almost all of our 12 months worth of themes. And that is because it's so recent. The COVID pandemic has shown us what can happen if that you've got a wide swath or segment of your cities or your regions population who is sick and who's unhealthy and they cannot work and add to the system, that is impacting on the availability, the shortages, you know, like a lot of the food shortages. And I heard last night it's a baby formula shortage. Now, I'm not sure theirs was due to labor. Theirs may have been due to some other thing. But so many of the shortages and other inconveniences, and even beyond inconveniences, issues that we are seeing today in our country, and I imagine other countries are experiencing the same, are because of the ravages of the pandemic on, quote, those essential workers who tend to be low income and minority.
Yeah, people of color, disproportionately. 9 out of 10 essential workers are folks of color.
Exactly. And so we just saw what happened when they are disproportionately burdened by disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that showed us as a society why we need to care, even though we're not part of those populations.
No, I mean, let me just chime in on that. So let's talk about the built environment. So we're talking about the built environment leads to, you know, indirectly or directly impacts people's health, or indirectly impacts people's behaviors. Context, place matters, impacts lifestyles. You can have people who don't have access to healthy foods, they eat unhealthy foods, you have diabetes, heart disease. Also built environment, many of our communities, we have highways and byways that go to the community. So a lot of people are dealing with poor air quality, right? So you have poor air quality in communities. They don't have access to food. And in another part of the built environment, they live in housing where they've been exposed to mold, mildew, allergens, volatile organic compounds, okay? Why did I mention all those things together? Those exposures can lead to adverse health outcomes. So diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and also asthma. And then you got COVID. COVID sees those populations. You're an easy target if you got asthma. You're an easy target, you have diabetes. You're an easy target, you've had a stroke. You're an easy target when you have underlying health issues. You're an easy target if you live in an area with air pollution. So then COVID impacts those populations who disproportionately are folks of color, and they are essential workers who work in transit system, who work in a grocery store, who work in a restaurant, who work in, you know, healthcare. And so those essential workers are sick, they're ill themselves, so it creates inconveniences for everyone else. Also, there's social costs, there are economic costs, there are health costs that the larger population has to absorb. So we want to make sure we address the differential impacts of the pandemic. We have to make sure we address the root causes that led to the pandemic disproportionate impact on those folks in the first place. And having a poor built environment is one of those what we call social determinants of health. Transportation is social determinant of health. Healthcare is social determinant of health. Schools are social determinant of health, right? Food is social determinant of health. We have to address the social determinants of health. And by putting the work on the front end, we can spend less on the back end, okay?
Indeed. And I think to some degree, COVID is what happened is an opportunity because everybody sees S and saw. They can't really see what happens off in the neighborhoods or in a person's home, but everybody sees, saw, and felt, and still feeling COVID.
We're still, regardless of what people think, we're still in the pandemic.
Yeah, we are. See, that's why I put the S on C's. We saw, we see, we've experienced.
Exactly.
It's both. But I'm making the distinction. Everybody can see that. They don't necessarily see what happens, you know, at the lower community base in people's homes in the streets, but they can see COVID. And so I thought that was a really good a point. That here's what we're talking about. Here's how it affects you. Do you ever wonder? This is why you have to care. So I just wanted to bring that out. And like I said, it's just an opportunity for many of the other. Environmental and health connected issues that our society.
If we invest in communities and invest in healthy built environments, that investment is prevention. It's precautionary. It saves you money. Okay. It saves you time. It saves us aggravation when somebody's, you know, again, the inconveniences, but really it's a lot of savings that comes from really focused on prevention. I'm a public health scientist, and a lot of times public health doesn't get a lot of investments. But really, the pandemic shows us we have to invest in public health. And what we're saying, the reason why people are so impacted, because of their poor built environments, from transportation to housing to access to food, right? These things are central elements of a community. And when you have poor access to them or poor quality, it's going to impact your health, and it's going to be ripples across all of society, as we've seen with the pandemic, as you've already well stated.
Indeed. And that's what we really, the purpose of, one of the purposes of Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, is to help people unpack that and understand it in their everyday lives, how they are affected by health, again, as well as everything around them. So I want to move now, Jacoby, to look at, I guess, healthy cities' effect or interaction with the natural environment, including wildlife. I think that I recall that there's a lot of research, you know, going on here, but how are cities impacting the environment around them?
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. I mean, the one thing about cities, that how they impact the environment around them, think about, you know, the populations and urbanization. We produce a lot of waste, right? So you may have a sewage treatment system. You may have a combined sewer system where, you know, you have a major rain event. And then you have, you know, stormwater runoff or sewage backup. And then what does that material go? What does that waste go when we have sewage backs up or stormwater runoff? It goes into our rivers and streams, right? And so if you have a lot of traffic, remember I said, you know, built environment, our highways and byways, we have a love affair with cars in this country, but we still burn a lot of gasoline. I would advocate that folks should try to get an electric vehicle because that means you're not burning fossil fuels, and which means you would have less pollution that impacts air quality, but also from your chemistry class, y'all, what goes up must come down, dry deposition, wet deposition. And so that material can then run off also. Those chemicals can also get into our rivers and streams and kill fish, right? Impact aquatic wildlife. And then we have poor air quality, right? It impacts the health of not just humans, but also our wildlife. So we have pollution, you know, our waste, even like our trash. Where does that trash go? It can impact environmental quality as well. When you have landfills and you have incinerators, okay? And also a lot of our cities, we don't have enough trees.
Yeah.
That's a big issue.
Very much. And I want to talk a little bit more about the natural environment on the other side of the break with Dr. Jacoby Wilson with the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, to today's show on cities, built environment, and infrastructure. And we're looking at healthy cities, healthy people, that intersection with the built environment. And we are back with Dr. Jacoby Wilson, University of Maryland, School of Public Health, and he is just making us much smarter. Thank you again for being with us, Jacoby. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me today.
Thanks. And before the break, you were, again, giving us some examples and explaining that interaction, but you were talking about how, like you said, we have this feedback loop where we, who are part of the built environment and make this built environment, we spew forth toxins and all sorts of other bad things that then affect the natural environment around us. And while I know you're not a wildlife expert, it's got to affect the wildlife too, because they're out there too, and they're part of that natural environment.
Yeah, now you think about, you know, some of our local species when it comes to plant species. You think about some of our, you know, a very sort of wildlife population that we normally see within cities. You know, they are also exposed to the same toxicants that we're exposed to, particularly when we combust fossil fuels. When we think about the, you know, transportation and all the commuter vehicles, all the big trucks, all the buses, the diesel exhaust, the volatile compounds, particulate matter, all those things that combustion byproducts, they are also impacted. So you can see, you know, mortality rates in those populations. When you think about birds, for example, there's been studies that have shown that they can be exposed to things like mercury and other contaminants. You can see those impacts on reproduction, right? You can look at impacts of runoff in our rivers and streams and impact in the fish. Fish, their lipid tissue, their fatty tissue, they can bioaccumulate those toxicants. So those of you who go out there and fish in your local rivers and stream, I'm not sure if you should eat that fish if you're near an area that has a lot of industrial activity, you know, petrochemical operations, or, you know, factories, power plants, or even small polluters where you have runoff or deposition, because those animals, they bioaccumulate those materials, and then you end up being exposed to them when you consume those animals.
Indeed, and as I recall from our month of themes about pollution, they have the nanoplastics in them, too, that are causing...
Yes. And then another feedback loop, we talk about when we spew out, you know, pollutants, right? I like to say, you may not believe in climate change, but climate change believes in you. Think about greenhouse gas emissions. When we burn fossil fuels, when we burn energy, you know, when we use energy in our homes to heat our homes, releasing, you know, greenhouse gases, releasing carbon dioxide, you may have methane emissions. Those things can impact, you know, lead to climate-related events, maybe have more rainfall, could be contributing to more hurricanes, intense hurricanes. You had this whole thing called the urban heat island effect. What that is, because we have a lot of concrete and asphalt, that's part of our built environment in our cities. And when you have the albedo effect, when you have the sunlight hits the ground, because the concrete, the asphalt, the blacktop, it absorbs that heat and re-releases that heat. So you can have a heat island because of that. And you have the gases that are climate forcing get trapped in that heat island. So think about the intersection of heat and air pollution in our cities, and then because you don't have trees act as the lungs of our cities. They cannot take in that pollution. So trees are good for shading and cooling. Trees are good for heat mitigation. So the combination of not having trees, having too much concrete and asphalt, and in some places we don't have air conditioning, that's why you're seeing more people have heat stroke and seeing more people die from heat events because of our built environment and its intersection with our natural environment or the lack of natural environment.
I want to unpack a little bit more something that you mentioned, and that is like pavement, asphalt,
yep,
impervious cover, and the many and varied impacts that it has. I know one of them that you mentioned was normally when the sun beats down, it's absorbed into the plant life or whatever. But when there's asphalt, what's the difference?
Yeah, so when you have more asphalt, it's going to be warmer, right, in those locations. There's this report in Baltimore called Baltimore Code Red about climate change and heat issues in Baltimore. And students did a study to look at temperature differences between houses on the same row that had a tree and a house that didn't have a tree. You see a 20-degree difference in temperature from the next house to the next house because of one tree. And so having green infrastructure acts to cool the environment, right? Keeps things cool. When you don't have it, things are going to be warmer. Your house is going to be warmer. Your street's going to be warmer. Your neighborhood's going to be warmer. So when you go outside, you're going to be extra hot. When you go into the park, you're going to be extra hot. When your kids go outside to play, they're going to be extra hot. When your elderly mother goes outside, she's going to be extra hot because of the lack of natural infrastructure, because of the lack of green space, because of the lack of trees.
And that was all part built environment. You know what I was sitting here thinking, though, you were talking, because I'm like a student of how do we motivate people to do these right things, these required things. Now I think if we could come up with some statistics, or even the electric companies make a commitment, which is I doubt that they would, is like your power bill will go down X dollars every month if you plant a tree. I bet we'd have trees all over the place.
That would be great. There is information out there like that. I believe, I think there's institutes that actually do that research. You see the savings, but that gets back to the earlier point about saving money. If you have trees in your neighborhood, your bill is lower. You know, if you have trees in your neighborhood, you should actually have an improvement of health outcomes. Trees are beneficial not just for heating, shading, and cooling, but trees are also beneficial to improving the air quality. So we should have less asthma-related events, less asthma attacks. There's a lot of benefits for having trees that we can see, and the money that we save, and benefits for our health, and benefits for just quality, overall quality of life.
And I seem to be seeing cities all over this country moving to some local building codes or zoning codes that are addressing trees and making sure that they're not cut down. If they are, they're replacing or whatever. So, you know, that is really finally catching on.
I think cities like Chicago has programs. I think Chicago has a green roof program. Like we can have, think about everybody. You can plant trees on your roof. You can do green walls, right? Okay. Cities like Portland are doing things as well. Baltimore's doing some things. New York City, there's a lot of our major cities there that are bringing infrastructure, natural infrastructure, back to our cities. There was a report a few years ago that said that there's a nature gap in our communities, in our cities. Blacks, folks of color, have 3 times less access to nature compared to their white counterparts, and low-wealth folks have 3 times less access to nature compared to their wealthy counterparts. That means a lot when it comes to mitigation and adaptation for climate change. It means a lot when it comes to how do you have a healthy community and how do you have a healthy population. If you don't have a healthy community, I mean, think about communities. They're actually living and breathing organisms themselves. So they're unhealthy. Then, of course, the people who live in the communities are going to be unhealthy. And the built-in natural environments have a major role in that.
Well, now, but, you know, you mentioned that, and so I'm thinking trees. There's very few trees in places like New York City.
Well, we do have Central Park. You know, one of the largest parks in the country, right?
Yeah.
So in the places where you don't have a lot of trees, you know, what are some other things you can do to reduce heat, or have options for folks when there is a heat wave? So you have cooling stations, right? You can have resilience hubs. Or we have a place where, you know, we got folks who are going to be ambulatory. They're going to have to access medicines. We have a place where we have ventilators. We have backup ventilators. We have backup power storage. Those are things that you can do because of climate change and heat issues, we're going to see more heat waves. I mean, Texas experienced the extreme winter storm last year, right? All the power loss. So it's not just the heat issues, but just even in the wintertime, those extreme winter events, we got to make sure we have resources and infrastructure in place for folks.
Indeed. Now, so, Jacoby, what are some other ways, perhaps, that climate change can affect the health of cities?
I think if you think about, again, I think one of the biggest issues, and you mentioned COVID before, I would say heat waves. Think about a heat wave and a hurricane and COVID. Didn't that happen in Texas last year? Right? You're dealing with 3 major issues at the same time. And for cities, you have populations that are ambulatory, that are sick and shut in, that are in nosocomial settings, you know, nursing homes and hospital settings. How do we make sure we protect those populations, right? So I would say heat is a big issue. Also a big issue is episodic rain events. Because of all this, you talked about impervious surfaces. Just think about everybody, impervious surfaces. They got concrete and asphalt, you know, on the ground. When it rains, where's that water going? It's going to run off.
We have that issue in my hometown of Austin, Texas. But I can tell you this. They use, again, the zoning laws. Anything built or substantial rehab, when it segues into the built, there's only a certain percentage of every lot in the city is zoned for how much percentage can be impervious cover. The average is usually no more than 30-40% can that lot be impervious cover. Because they have serious flooding issues.
That's great for Austin. For the fourth largest city in the country, Houston, there's no zoning.
I know. That was all. When I was in college, Houston was always the joke about because of its no zoning. But Austin really was driven into it because of the bad flooding, and it was really bad. There could be like whole neighborhoods almost flooding when it rains.
You have sunny day flooding. Like it's, you know, sunny day flooding could happen. You have these episodic rain events. And now even like I said with Houston, as you know, has had these 1,000-year flood events, rain events, and a lot of it's because the water has nowhere to go. So we don't have any green space. You don't have any natural sponge to absorb, no wetlands to absorb that water. Think about it. We've even paid over our urban rivers. So not having that type of urban river system to absorb that water is also a problem too. So that's a challenge in the built environment, and we need to modify and make sure we have access to more urban rivers.
Indeed, and we're going to talk some more about our challenges and issues with cities and with health on the built environment on the other side of the break. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority, or the DFW Metroplex and North Texas Communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all Whole Foods markets, natural grocers, central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Check them out at nhg.com. And our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at lynndentalcare.com. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, to today's show on cities, built environment, and infrastructure. And today we're talking about specifically healthy cities, healthy people, and that intersection with our built environment. And we are back with Dr. Jacoby Wilson with the University of Maryland School of Public Health. And before the break, we were talking about the intersection of climate change in our health. And I want to really key in on climate change, the intersection with climate change and our built environment. How is it affecting how we're doing the built environment? Or is it making things worse the way it is? Or is it making us do better and be more intentional about our built environment? What's going on there?
I mean, if you think about some of the climate-related, I like to say climate-related perturbations, right? You have forest fires, you have flood events, you have sea level rise, you have tornadoes, you have hurricanes, you have heat waves. When you think about our buildings, we have to build buildings that can adapt to climate change. We have to build, in some parts of the country, build buildings that are now more fire resistant, right? In some parts of the country, we have to build buildings that can withstand level 5 hurricane? I mean, you think, was it last year? You can correct me on this. Didn't the Gulf Coast get 7 named hurricanes last year? Is that right?
That's all. I thought it was more.
And so we have to make sure that we are building buildings, housing that can withstand these events. And when it comes to our, you know, most vulnerable populations, we have to make sure that we're helping them be able to live in climate resilient neighborhoods as well. It just can't be just for the wealthy, right? Just for the well-to-do, just for folks who have access, who have political power, who have political voice. And so I think that's part of it. You can look at flooding issues. We have to build sewer systems that can deal with all the new rainfall. Hurricane Harvey dumped 30 trillion gallons of rain in Houston. That's a lot of rain. So how are you going to have a sewer system that can deal with all that rain? We got to move away from having so many impervious surfaces. We got to bring in bioswales and more green space and green infrastructure, more wetlands, renew our urban rivers and urban streams to absorb that water.
Let me ask you this, though. From where you sit, and you see a lot of things and your involvement around the country in terms of environmental science and the health and communities, and I think a lot of issues is we got caught, but that was back then. We got caught in Katrina, maybe just recent history that we can all remember. We got caught with the extreme weather that took us very much by surprise. But I think we're at a point where we know it's going to happen. I think everybody's accepting the extreme weather because we just see it over and over and over. Same thing with fires. And people are seeing these recent years, this year particularly, how the fires are now moving. Now, the scientists knew. We're in the third season, and scientists and experts are telling us on our show in the first season. They're saying, oh, it's more common. So, it's like we have to be looking forward because we kind of have to, looks like we may have to run a sprint to get ahead of it. Because extreme weather events are coming, and probably one of the challenging issues is you don't know the nature of the extreme weather this year. Like Texas had the snows and everything that people are still on us about 2 years ago. Well, now this year, I don't know what's going to happen, but we are all kind of on pins and needles because it's so hot so quick already. What are you seeing in terms of us looking forward, the experts, the scientists, public health, public policy?
You know, I think I would say that regardless of how you feel about it politically, you know, this administration has tried to put some focus on climate change. So you have Executive Order 14008 that focuses on climate change. You have the Justice 40 initiative of this administration that talks about as we move away from a dirty energy economy, fossil fuels, which is a big part of the infrastructure and economy in Texas, to a clean energy economy. But Houston is, the country's leader in clean energy, actually. Houston City, Houston is. So clean energy economy.
Well, you do know Texas is, I guess, bifurcated because we're also among the top few, if not the top one. I think we may volley between California and someplace else of wind energy producers.
Wind energy, exactly. So I think you got to take the good with the bad. We want to get more good from Texas,
yep,
right?
Yep.
But that's an important part of the future. That's part of Texas's future. Mm-hmm. Texas could be a leader in the country, like you said, with California, as we move to renewables, as we move to clean energy. I mean, that is the future. And that's actually for us to have an economy that's actually viable. We need to have more investments in clean energy infrastructure. That's another part of the infrastructure. You talk about the built environment. It's our energy sector, right? And so I think that's what people are looking at. How do we build climate resilient cities? You already see cities across the country who are doing resilient, you know, building climate resilient infrastructure. Places like Baltimore, places like New York City. You have states that are passing climate equity acts. State of Maryland just passed one this session. Washington State passed one last year. New York is doing a lot of great climate work. I believe Illinois said they're going to shut down all their coal-fired power plants by the year 2035. California is doing a lot of work as it relates to advancing, you know, an agenda where we invest in the future. And the future is now when it comes to our energy infrastructure. The future is now as it relates to our transportation infrastructure. We have to, you know, move to electrified vehicles. We need to move to vehicles that don't run on fossil fuels. We also, the future is now when it comes to how we address our food issues, right? Because we have a lot of folks who are, and it's literally in this country, who are dealing with hunger every day. So how can we, you know, create food systems at the nexus of the food, energy, water nexus, right? So we're taking into account food issues, energy issues, and water issues at the same time. There's a lot that we're doing through the federal government as it relates to smart cities. You have USDA providing resources as it relates to addressing some of these infrastructure issues in rural areas, right? And so I would say there are a lot of good things that are happening in some of our federal agencies when it comes to addressing some of these infrastructure issues and these built environment issues that we've been talking about during this discussion.
So they are sprinting.
They have to sprint.
Yeah, they have to sprint. Now, let me ask you this, though. Have you seen... Well, I'm sure you've seen, or if they exist, you've seen. are any examples of how or when or that the natural environment has evolved or changed or whatever as a result of the built environment?
I mean, you can look at a number of examples. When you look at pollution emissions from our cities, right, and how it changes the quality of our rivers and streams, the number of fish kills, as an example, you look at the inputs into the Gulf Coast, right? You think about our spills and the impact on the Gulf Coast. That's an obvious example of how the natural environment's been changed, right? If you look at issues around climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, I mean, we're dealing with issues of drought right now in California, is in one of the worst droughts. Look at what happened last year with the Pacific heat dome, right? And its impact on human health, but also its impact on, flora as well in the Pacific Northwest. So you see examples across the country where we're losing species every day. We're losing our biodiversity because of anthropogenic, because of man-made activities.
Right.
So climate change is not just impacting us. Again, it's also impacting our natural environment. You can even look at changes in our zoonotic disease spread. So think about mosquitoes and other organisms that are bringing more of these diseases in other parts of the country. We might have seen them before. You can look at our pest distribution in our cities, that's a connection between that. You can even look at when it comes to allergies, there are more allergens, right? Because of climate change and association with allergens, and associates with allergies.
It's interesting that you say that, and we only have a couple of minutes to go. Interesting to say that because I believe on one of our local weather stations, they didn't go all into detail about it, but they did mention, they tried to, you know, wanting to tell people that pollution, your allergies are bad, and you've got your cedar and your oak and all of that driving pollution. But they said also this, because it's 90-some-odd degrees, ozone and the quality of air is also making your allergies worse. Last thing, and we just, like I said, we just have a couple more minutes, Jacoby, and that is for you to just tell, what can ordinary people do in their everyday lives to help drive solutions? What are some of those most important things people can do?
I mean, part of it is, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle. You know, recycling is one thing. For those of you who want to try to do more as it relates to the natural environment and reduce some waste that we produce, composting is one thing to do. For those of you who can afford to get solar, get community solar. Well, you don't have to get solar on your home or just get access to community solar, so you kind of buy into a solar pool, right?
Right.
So you can get your own solar panels. You can get electric cars if you can. Some are very expensive, I know. I will also say, you know, we kind of need to bring agriculture back into our cities. We should change zoning, actually have zoning in Houston, so you can actually bring in, people can have bees, apiaries in the cities. You can have, you know, animals in the cities. We need to do permaculture, bring trees and green space into our buildings. There's so much that we can do in how we build and maintain our cities. We need nature, just to be clear and cogent as possible. We need nature. Let's bring nature back to our cities.
Indeed. And I think that is very important, and really appreciate you spending time with us today to tell people that. And I think it's very important coming from an expert like you, who's on the ground, does the science, the research, knows the research, and you take your work, you know, put it into action, help communities and their various partnerships do that. And I think it's important what you said, too, about bringing this green back in, because those are some real hands-on things that everybody can do to some extent.
And bringing green can make you green, right? Because you make money in this climate economy. That's the important part. I want to make sure I say that. When you say bringing green can also make you green.
We are so glad that you could join us. We have today been with Dr. Jacoby Wilson with the University of Maryland School of Public Health. And he has really made us smarter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. And thank you, audience, for listening in today to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. The conversation starts here, but our goal is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is the result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day, like yourself. And each of those tiny acts can seem insignificant, but they all add up, one way or the other, to the change that we each live through. This is Bernice Butler, your host. Thank you so much for listening today. And join us again next week for more on cities, built environments, and infrastructure. Thank you.